Welcome to Useful Idiots.
I'm Matt Taibbi.
I'm Katie Halper.
And where are we in time right now?
We are now pre-debate, depending on when you hear this.
Right.
We'll definitely
this will
be
actually
post-debate.
Be after.
Yeah. By the time you see this, it'll mean that I've been...
Right, well, that we didn't die during the drinking game,
yeah.
So that's probably
or
good.
Or usually it's the opposite, but in this case, it's that, yeah.
Right. So we're gonna have the second part of our interview with Chris Hedges on in a little bit, and we thought we'd do just a little bonus episode beforehand.
Well, Matt, you have a big story.
Yeah, I did the latest campaign trail feature. So the next in line was Joe Biden. Went out and saw Joe on the campaign trail and did kind of a write-up of... where he's at, which is kind of an interesting story because Joe Biden's an interesting figure because he's had a lot of disasters in his political career, but yet he keeps kind of being projected upward because of them.
Right.
And this impeachment thing is kind of breaking in an interesting way for him because it could either ruin him,
right?
But it could also it's forcing the whole Democratic Party to throw themselves behind him too,
right? Because if not, you're letting the Russians win.
Yeah, or Trump being right or something like that, right? So he had a really bad third quarter in terms of fundraising. He was
Biden, right? Yeah,
he went way down from like 24 million to like 15, and he's behind even Buttigieg, and Bernie was at the top actually, and Warren was just behind him. But they're now considering putting a pack together to create a defense fund for Biden.
What?
Yeah.
Who's doing this?
So this was in the news as I was putting this to bed. There's a group of high profile Democratic donors who are now weighing whether or not that's the smart thing to do. So, and the reason they would have to do it is because they're trying to figure out how best to counter some of the information that's coming out about his son. And the stuff about his son is, I don't know, how do you feel about it?
I think we said this a couple episodes ago, but it's not great.
Right.
And I think it's kind of a sign of how much Trump, it's like any, you know, there's anybody but Trump.
Right.
This is like anything but Trump.
Right.
So anything that happens that isn't Trump level,
right,
or Trump related, I guess, kind of gets a pass.
Yeah, they've got Hunter on with interviews today and the day of the debates, and they're basically asking him, did you ever maybe have second thoughts that, you know, getting on the board of a you know, Ukrainian gas company without actually having any expertise
right.
was a good idea? And he sort of says, you know, in hindsight, you know, maybe yes, you
right.
know. So, but the other interesting thing, and you know, I asked the Biden campaign about this, is that one of the talking points about all this is that Joe Biden, when he asked the Ukrainians to fire Viktor Shokin,
right,
the prosecutor, that there were no active investigations of Burisma at
right.
the time. And in the last week, there were a couple of, well, there's an old story that was actually published in Russia and Ukraine in 2016 that suggested that Burisma's CEO was actually had his property seized after that moment. So that kind of runs counter to that. And then there was a story that Novaya Gazeta, which is the Russian opposition newspaper, they just did a big expose last week that was ignored here in the States. That I know the reporter who wrote it, this woman, Yulia Latinina.
Latinx.
Latinx?
Just kidding.
Yeah. And she basically what she says is that there was an open case in Ukraine involving this guy Sergei Korchenko, who was like stealing money from Ukrainian businesses and funneling it to, among other things, Rosemont Seneca, Biden's son's company, through Burisma. So that story just came out, and they didn't exactly deny it. They didn't comment on the record about it, but that story's out there and it's going to come out. So this all this stuff about Hunter Biden, I don't know. It's hard to say. I think it's going to be. It could break both ways.
Somehow, I missed what he looked like, and I was impressed by his plugs. He seems to have his father's plugs. Yeah, which is like a good way to look like. I like that. It's kind of smart. It's like if he has these weird hair, this weird follicle situation going on, and his dad has it too. Maybe they're not transplants. Maybe they just have that.
Like they naturally grow.
Well,
plugs?
I think that's what they're that's what they're trying to suggest. Like maybe they go to the same plugs place, so that they can like, have generational coherence.
Like a familial continuity.
Yeah, exactly.
Editor?
Right. Yeah.
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 I see.
Like there's intergenerational trauma. That's the thing. So you can have intergenerational hair plugs.
Right.
I went to school with a girl who had like definitely had the same nose job as her mom did. So that's another good way to hide it in.
Synchronize the nose.
Yeah,
job
exactly.
As well.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. No, he's a mess, Hunter Biden. You can get a perfectly good job just being the son of the vice president. You don't have to do anything. Like people will hire you at a private equity company, and they'll just put you in an office, and you'll make really good money.
I'm a human. And you know what? Did I make a mistake? Well, maybe in the grand scheme of things, yeah. But did I make a mistake based upon some unethical lapse? Absolutely not.
Why did you leave the board in April?
It's a 5-year term.
And you chose not to continue.
I chose not to. Yeah.
Why?
I think it's pretty obvious why.
This is your opportunity to say why.
Well, because this is what becomes a distraction, because I have to sit here and answer these questions. And so that's why I've committed that I won't serve on any boards or I won't work directly for any foreign entities when my dad becomes president.
Like, why go out of like, he's on the board of these foreign companies. He had a seat on Amtrak a long time ago, and Tom Carper, the senator from Delaware, actually wrote him a letter on his behalf recommending him, and basically his expertise was that Hunter Biden rides the trains a lot.
Like his dad. Another thing like his dad. Isn't Biden like Mr. Amtrak?
Hey guys, back on Amtrak.
I guess so, but I mean, I don't know if he ever asked for a paid job on Amtrak because he rides the trains a lot. And, you know, he had that job as a consultant with MBNA, the credit card company, too. And then, you know, the other thing about Biden is like, I don't like to use the word gaffes because that's not an accurate term for what they are. But, I mean, it's gotten out of hand. Did you see the thing about the bathhouses?
Oh, that was great.
Right?
Yeah,
come
that was
on,
really
man.
Great, yeah.
Remember, Anderson, back 15, 20 years ago, we talked about this in San Francisco. It was all about, well, you know, gay bathhouses. And it's all about round-the-clock sex. It's all, come on, man. Gay couples are more likely to stay together longer than heterosexual couples.
He's still up in the polls. He's still, like, despite all these stories about Elizabeth Warren overtaking him, he's still got the lead. And can you imagine what it's going to look like if...
No, and there was the bathhouse response, and then there was Warren's response about, like, if someone doesn't believe in same-sex marriage and they believe in faith or something, how are you going to respond to that? Did you see that?
A supporter approaches you and says, Senator, I am old-fashioned, and my faith teaches me that marriage is between one man and one woman. What is your response?
Well, I'm going to assume it's a guy who said that. And I'm going to say, then just marry one woman. I'm cool with that. Assuming you can find one.
But she planned it, right?
Well, the guy who asked the question is from Human Rights Campaign,
yes,
and like a maxed out donor to her campaign, which wasn't revealed, which is, you know, it's just interesting. I wonder what planted questions there will be tonight.
Oh, well, yeah, they all have.
We should have added that to our drinking game.
Well, I think there is a rule for scripted witticisms. There usually is.
But I mean, someone in the audience who has a relationship with the candidate, that's not.
Right.
Like Bernie's would be that guy in the, you saw that Bernie video where he's just walking down around Wall Street and some UPS guy just like passes by and gives him a smack on the shoulder.
Oh, because he's a friend of the working man?
It's not fake. He's just like walking through. It's like one of the best images ever.
Excellent.
They could have, yeah, that would be a good guy to ask him a question.
Wow.
Can we talk about your piece about the coup stuff or is that
off limits?
A little
bit.
It's not.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like sort of in internet hiding right now because that kind of blew up in a way I wasn't anticipating. So,
all right. Well, let's just own it.
Yeah,
you know?
I guess.
Like, okay,
yeah.
People are already trying to cancel you and they've failed.
Yeah.
So you might as well celebrate.
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay.
I
so, Matt, you wrote this piece. In addition to your Joe Biden piece, you have a piece that you released elsewhere.
Yeah, in Substack, yep.
Mm-hmm. Called "We're in a Permanent Coup. Americans might soon wish they just waited to vote their way out of the Trump era."
Mm-hmm.
This got you almost in more trouble, if possible, than your last piece where you talked about whistleblowers. Yeah. So tell us about this piece and what you were saying and why people lost their minds even more than usual from your writing.
Like, if you look at the whole timeline of the impeachment thing, and it was sort of a continuation of Russiagate, and this has been going on a long time, and you have to think about it in the context of like what's happened since before even Trump's presidency began. Like, I can't stand Donald Trump. I covered him. He's completely ridiculous.
You were ahead of the curve on
like,
that one.
I don't like Hillary Clinton, and I went into the voting booth and I voted for her because, like, for all the reasons, you can't vote for Donald Trump. But when he got elected, the four heads of the security agencies, Comey from the FBI, the CIA chief John Brennan, the DIA, James Clapper, and Mike Rogers, the admiral from the NSA, they went to Trump before impeachment and they presented him with the Steele dossier, which that they knew was fake at the time, or they had had plenty of time to investigate anyway, like a half a year. And they said, we're telling you this so that don't worry about blackmail. We're going to keep it close. We're going to make sure that the news agencies don't have a hook to publish this. And then they leaked it like instantaneously within days. So just imagine what Democrats would think if the security heads had done that to Obama before he had.
Right.
And the only reason people aren't flipping out about it is because it's Donald Trump. Like, if this were any other instance where you had the security heads sabotaging a president before they took office, it would be kind of a big deal. And then you add to that this constant string of leaked stories, many of which turned out not to be true or defamatory, like in the next couple of years. They were, they're putting their toe into domestic politics in a way they never really have before.
Right.
And that's all I'm really saying in this. And that.
So you love Trump.
Exactly. Yeah.
You want to marry Trump.
I just can't. I just can't stand. They're just pounding you over the head with this impeachment stuff.
Right.
It's like 5,000 times a day, and I can't do it anymore. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
Well, no. My thing is that it's not. There's this like lack of emotional distance from what's happening that I think actually prevents people from seeing how to effectively oppose Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these people who are constantly talking about impeachment, ironically, I think are in many ways enabling him and empowering him. Not intentionally, but I just think that they don't know how to respond to him in a kind of clever way or in a way that gets people who don't already care to care.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing. Like, and I do worry that, there's so many avenues that you could go to go after Trump, and they're really abandoning those because of the impeachment.
There's also the question that it's not really about anything. Neither this nor Russiagate, it wasn't about making people's lives better. It's just like this constant intermucine, investigation, power struggle, Washington, power play thing. And I don't think that's the way you fix the problem of Donald Trump. Like, he was elected, and the only reason people voted for him is because they literally could not bring themselves to vote for someone else who represented one of the two major political parties. And so I think but they're not looking at it that way. This is just his presidency is illegitimate. We're gonna terminate it. And I think that's going to fire. You're right. I think that's going to fire up his base even more. But
yeah, it'll fire up his base. I don't think it registers with people who don't already care that much.
Mm-hmm.
I think that. I mean, and you have a just reading from your piece. You write. You open with, "I've lived through a few coups. They're insane, random, and terrifying. Like watching sports, except your political future depends on the score." I'm curious about your coup days, but
there's 91 and then there was a thing in Russia called the Xerox box affair where Yeltsin's bodyguard tried to arrest Yeltsin's campaign people, and then Yeltsin's campaign people had the bodyguard arrested. So there was a couple of days there where it wasn't clear actually who was in charge of the government. So the Russians they called that like a mini putsch, there was a moment of uncertainty about who was actually running things.
Sounds like a Three Stooges.
Yeah, it was kind of like an old school comedy. And it was in Uzbekistan when Islam Karimov who was the now longstanding dictator there, he arrested the opposition party while I was there, which not quite the same thing as like a 91 situation, but you know, these things start when somebody basically refuses to recognize the authority of the executive, right? And I think, you know, you kind of sort of have a situation like that where the four intelligence agencies kind of broke from the president before, right? All I'm really saying,
which is why people's minds broke with your piece about whistleblowers, because again, they were like, you were saying whistleblowers kind of by definition are vulnerable, they lose a lot, they lose their, right, you know, their homes, their work, their jobs, sometimes their families, and people are like, but what do you mean this whistleblower is being threatened by Trump, which he of course being. Mm-hmm. But again, this is the first time where the intelligence community and the executive branch are not in lockstep. So people just, I don't think they get that.
Right, yeah. So this is a whistleblower, kind of, but it's, you know, a whistleblower with the backing of the people who usually crush whistleblowers.
Right, yes.
So it's like a, you know, it's a confusing situation. That's why all this, right, the part of that story that really struck me as false is all this, oh my God, we have to like stand with the whistleblowers, right, like stuff that's on TV all of a sudden. And it's the same people who, you know, didn't have a time of day for actual whistleblowers or on the wrong side of like the Assange thing, for instance, right? So that's, you know, there's a difference between like a power struggle between two big institutional forces and like what a normal whistleblower situation is, you know.
Right. Which is like everyone against.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Everybody sort of piling on a single person. So.
And you write, my discomfort in the last few years, first with Russiagate and now with Ukrainegate and impeachment, stems from the belief that the people pushing hardest for Trump's early removal are more dangerous than Trump. Many Americans don't see this because they're not used to waking up in a country where you're not sure who the president will be by nightfall. They don't understand that this predicament is worse than having a bad president. Yeah, I think people don't think about that, and they think it's like treasonous to say that.
Right, and I get it. People, and I understand why people can't stand Donald Trump and they think he's like the worst thing. I just think that having the subtext of everything leading up to 2016 is that the intelligence agencies have been gradually asserting more and more crazy powers, right? Whether it's surveillance or, you know, the rendition, the indefinite detention, all those things, right? And the last thing we want to do is have them decide that they're going to get involved with domestic politics. And we've seen since the Russiagate thing started that there, you know, there are these partnerships with Facebook and Google to, you know, to control like fake news, right? All that. You know, they hauled them into the Senate and asked them all to create a plan for stopping the foment of discord and all these things. I just think are more dangerous, you know, long term.
Right.
But you know, I could be wrong. It's just
you say, I don't believe most Americans have thought through what a successful campaign to oust Donald Trump would look like. Most casual news consumers can only think of it in terms of Mike Pence becoming president. The real problem would be the precedent of a de facto intelligence community veto over elections, using the lunatic spook world brand of politics that has dominated the last 3 years of anti-Trump agitation. CIA, FBI-backed impeachment could also be a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is also a really good point. If Donald Trump thinks he's going to be jailed upon leaving office, he'll sooner or later figure out that his only real move is to start acting like the quote-unquote dictator MSNBC and CNN keep insisting he is. Why give up the White House and wait to be arrested when he still has theoretical authority to send special forces,
repelling
through the windows of every last Russiagate, Ukrainegate leaker? That would be the end game in a third world country, and it's where we're headed unless someone calls off this craziness. Welcome to the permanent power struggle. Welcome to the permanent power struggle. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I have a friend who we knew, and I knew him in Russia, and the first thing he said about all this business is, yeah, I mean, if Trump actually were somebody like Putin, then the next news story you'd be reading is like, you know, the guys with masks, you know, kind of crashing through the windows of whoever, all the people who had access to this information, and they'd be dragged out, and they'd be, you know, there would be an actual attempt to scare the people away from doing this, and that hasn't happened yet, but it could. I mean, you know, if he thinks that this is the end game in countries where presidents are afraid to leave office because they think they're going to get jailed, is they always inevitably like exercise more power when they were worried about that. So that's why it's always good to have the peaceful transfer of power whenever you can, even you know. So.
And what does the CIA and the FBI do that's so bad to play liberal person Matt Taibbi?
Well, I mean, in the last couple of years, I would argue that the thing that they did was that was really bad was they intentionally circulated the phony story about, you know, Trump being a Russian agent.
Right.
I mean, again, for all the things that Trump did wrong, that story turned out not to have a there. And I think they knew that pretty early, and yet they were continually leaking that to the news. And again, people think of it, they don't think of it in terms of the presidency. They think of it in terms of Donald Trump, so screw him, right?
Yeah.
But actually, it's kind of, you know, it's not good for the country to be leaking word that the president is a foreign agent if he's actually not, you know.
Yeah.
I don't see what so that's what the thing that I worry about is, if this works, there's going to be a precedent for how to do this. You just continually push stuff, and you have allies in the media who are going to help you do that, and, you know.
But also in terms of just the, like, recent history of the FBI and the CIA, I think people, they've become so kind of like neocons who used to be seen as war criminals. They've become so rehabilitated, relatively speaking, just by Trump's existence.
Well, right. People don't think about when we had a court case just last week where we found out that the FBI was doing tens of thousands of warrantless searches per month. You know, accessing the NSA's FISA database. You know, the CIA, you know, has its drone assassination program. You know, again, the secret prisons, all that stuff. I mean, this stuff is all terrible, right?
Right.
Objectively, they're doing paramilitary operations in in seven different countries or whatever it is. Stuff's all bad. I mean, I think the thing is, public opinion on that has radically changed since Trump came around. Because if you remember, heading into 2016, you know, there was a lot of anger towards, you know, this about over the surveillance thing, over, you know, so it's been interesting watching all this.
Yeah.
Let's talk to Chris Hedges, who has a lot of interesting things to say about journalism and about its career. And it was a great talk.
Also, not a fan of the intelligence community.
That's true. He is not. I always thought that your career really embodied something that Chomsky talked about in Manufacturing Consent, which is that the pressure isn't really so much, nobody comes and red pencils your copy and tells you not to write this or that. It's more about the point of hire, right? If you're the kind of person who doesn't kind of write what they want, you'll get a reputation for being a difficult person or emotional or one of these things, and you just kind of won't make your way up.
They'll send you to, like, you know, Knight Business.
Right.
That's what they did to Ray Bonner, something like that. Obits or...
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Something like that.
So what happened? What was your denouement with the New York Times? Because obviously you were writing front page stories. You did... You were covering, you know, all the major events, you know, overseas in the 80s, 90s, you know, early 2000s. You obviously one of their most valuable correspondents. You win the Pulitzer Prize, but there was tension, right? So what happened?
Well,
there?
Because people like me, newspapers or news organizations need people with my characteristics, which is basically comes down to if you go there, we'll kill you, and we go anyway.
Right.
Which doesn't really fit into the corporate mentality of the New York Times in the newsroom, which is why good war correspondents never, ever go back to the newsroom. They always get pushed out.
Can you think of an example? I can't think of anybody.
No,
we're
not really built like that.
Right.
So it's always an uncomfortable relationship on the part of the paper. But on the other hand, you're kind of a necessary evil. They need to put up with you because they need somebody that's going to drive into Sarajevo when it's being hit with 2,000 shells a day. I mean, and that's a personality type.
And it's not Brian Williams, right?
No.
Even though Brian pretended Williams. He'd been on the...
Brian?
Yeah. Remember that story about him being in the helicopter that wasn't set?
I want to apologize. I said I was traveling in an aircraft that was hit by RPG fire. I was instead in a following aircraft.
Most of the TV correspondents who came in to Sarajevo when I was there, who came in for like a two-week thing, like Brian Williams, to credentialize themselves, spent all of their time in the nuclear bunker below the Sarajevo inn, shitting their pants.
Like in the titanium sphere.
No, there
basically.
Is one. Yeah, below there was one. Yeah, and they were like, they wouldn't even sleep upstairs. Yeah, they were.
I still couldn't believe he got caught and then rehabilitated.
Yeah, but these people aren't journalists. Come on. I mean, they're just celebrities. Yeah, they're journalists don't make $10 million a year or whatever they pay these people.
Yeah. I almost don't begrudge them that, but yeah.
You don't begrudge them the $10
million? Well, yeah, I guess maybe I should. Yeah.
Well, it's Faustian. I mean, they've completely sold their soul and their integrity. So what were you asking me?
So Iraq and
Well, okay. I mean, on a more serious note, everybody has you can't cover war for everybody. Everybody has a breaking point. I ended covering the war in Kosovo. I was a physical and emotional wreck.
How long were you there?
Well, I'd been 20 years overseas from war to war to war. I just couldn't do it anymore. And then my closest friend, who I'd worked with for 10 years, Kurt Schork, gets killed in an ambush in Sierra Leone. He was, by the way, the administrative assistant in the office of Michael Harrington's office who fired me.
Wow.
Isn't that like bizarre?
What a bizarre.
Isn't that like bizarre? Anyway.
Did you ever reflect on that with him?
In his 40s, he decides to become a freelance reporter for Reuters in northern Iraq. And by that time, I'm the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. And somebody said, "Oh, Kurt wants to see you." He was in Zaho, or I don't know where he was, somewhere. And I was going to see him the next day. I said, "Yeah, tell him if he needs any papers filed, I'll be there." I just kind of broke down, and I had to stop. I took a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard, and I couldn't really do war anymore. Then comes the call to invade Iraq. Well, I spent months of my life in Iraq, 7 years in the Middle East. I realized, for all the reasons we know now, that this was insane and dangerous, and I spoke out against it, which reporters are not supposed to do. Although John Burns was cheerleading the war, it's
balance.
It's like the NYPD. They have lists of rules that they decide whether they want to enforce or not.
Right.
It was kind of the same. Mm-hmm. So nobody ever said anything to Burns because he was, parroting the appropriate line. And then I gave a commencement address at Rockford College where I was booed off the stage.
The curfew, the armed clashes with angry crowds that leave scores of Iraqi dead. The military governor.
I mean, at one point, 1,000 people got up and started singing God Bless America to drown.
Wow.
It's on YouTube. And they cut my mic. And then, like, at the end, these, like, couple guys from the graduating class get up to the podium and try and push me off. And so the right-wing media got a hold of that. And the way they do it is they lynch you. Well, you've written about this. So every hour, it was, like, me saying something for 30 seconds that was not patriotic. And Rush Limbaugh devoted like 4 days to me, and the Wall Street Journal wrote an editorial attacking me as a
left-wing
pacifist, which I'm not. I'm not a pacifist. And so the Times gave me a formal written reprimand, which under guild rules, you give the employee the reprimand, and then if they violate it, i.e. if I continued speaking out against the war, I'm fired. So I left before they fired me, yeah.
So was the reprimand about editorializing outside your lane?
It was about impugning the impartiality of the New York Times. Mm.
So I want to come back to that a little bit, because clearly things are a little different at the Times now, right? I mean, they encourage everybody to have a social media presence, to give their opinion about all sorts of things.
Yeah, but it's so not really.
Right.
They can give their opinion as long as it is part of the dominant narrative,
right.
Mm-hmm. i.e. Trump is a Russian agent. Being at war in the Middle East is a good thing. Yeah, I mean, it's what was it? Dorothy Parker said about Katharine Hepburn's emotional range as an actress. It goes from A to B. So that's kind of it. It goes from A to B. You can have all the opinions you want as long as it goes from A to B.
As long as they're
even
there.
The people who have Twitter presences. I mean, that's their supposed to be their outlet, maybe, but they are supposed to be. I mean, we've talked about this, that I think in some ways it's much scarier, scarier than the Jennifer Rubins at the Washington Post or like the Brett Stevens at the New York Times are the, you know, Sydney Embers at the New York Times, who claim to be objective, right? They still do claim to not be driven by their opinions, but of course they are. They just hide them.
Well, there are certain kinds of, I mean, they're very specific opinions, though. They're like the approved opinions.
Yeah. Sure, we can,
right.
You know.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's. I mean, I always talk about Bernie, but it's very clear. You can just trace it through their representation of Sanders or lack thereof.
Right.
He's either invisible or had a heart attack, and that's it.
Well, what did they do a piece a few weeks ago that dredged up every reference they could make to Noam Chomsky and the Sandinistas or something?
Oh, yeah, that was great.
Sydney
Ember was asked, she asked Sanders if he regretted, if he heard an anti-American chant when he was at a rally in Nicaragua, and if he had heard it, would he have stayed at the rally? That was her first question for Sanders.
Well, how about asking, since I was there,
yeah,
how many people were raped, murdered,
yeah, of course,
by the Contras, you know, who, you know, I mean, this is just ridiculous.
She, right, both sides did it. You know, it was, you know, both sides. And you know who one of her sources was, who she asked, whose opinion she sought, was Otto Reich.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
But that's a classic worthy and unworthy victims thing that Chomsky talks about,
right? Yeah, Chomsky nails that completely.
The whole Contras were, you know, they were.
Yeah. No, right. Okay, let's steal Matt Taibbi without. So Matt Taibbi writes. The great author Matt Taibbi writes. No, you are a great author. So you correctly point out that, you know, priests are being killed in Central America,
right,
by death squads who are funded by and backed by the United States, and then a priest is murdered in Poland at almost exactly the same time. And
right,
it's all the great illustration of,
yep,
right,
worthy and unworthy victims.
Right.
So we have that completely, yeah.
And then Ember goes back and interviews one of the people who was doing PR, literally, for the people murdering the priests. I mean, he worked for the Reagan administration.
Oh, right, right.
Like, killing pro-Sandinista stories and killing anti-Contra stories.
Which they revive only, because they only care now because it's somehow tangentially connected to Sanders.
Right,
which is something,
but they still care in the wrong way.
Right, yeah,
like, they're
exactly.
not, they still think the Sandinistas are the bad guys.
Well, let me tell you about the New York Times. There are no rules written on the side of the wall. But if you're an astute, i.e., you know, careerist, you very quickly figure out what they want and what they don't. And if you give them what they want, you will be rewarded. And, you know, the famous story is when they had the 1968 student takeover at Columbia University, and Abe Rosenthal got his butt up there as fast as he could to write about how they'd, you know, defiled or destroyed the books in the president's library, you know, I mean, stories like that. Well,
mm-hmm.
You know, that assured is rocketing the publisher who sat on the board of trustees at Columbia. I mean, so yeah, it's careerist. And so when I was hired by the Times, most people get vetted at the institution for usually up to a decade before they become a foreign correspondent. Because of the Arabic, I got hired. Mm-hmm. I was only in New York for 7 months and I'm overseas. So what they want is before they send you out, they want to know that you've been domesticated.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And if you know, that's the whole. And so those people who, I mean, you know, Roger Cohen, I mean, he's the perfect example. I mean, they know exactly what to say, what the appropriate opinion is. And
they're reliable.
Right. Yeah, they're reliable to the power elites who run the paper and the power elites whom the hierarchy of the paper are in alliance with, yeah.
One thing, and this is someone to segue to the work you've done since you left the Times, like your recent book, you know, America, a Farewell Tour. I think it's really interesting. We talked before, when you were doing the reporting from Gaza, you talked about how when you're there, there's just so many stories, you just don't,
yeah,
know what to do. Like, it's so overflowing with stuff. If you're in the right part of the world, or basically almost anywhere in the world, you can look in any direction and find a front page worthy story,
right?
But now, if you're here in America, you just go to any small town in this country, and it's just, you know, wall to wall misery, horror,
yeah.
And somehow, it's just not appearing on the news, right? You I feel like your reporting now on poverty in this country is essentially the same thing you were doing overseas, except it's here in America.
That's
now,
right.
Right? Yeah.
But it doesn't. You're right. I mean, that's the lives of the majority of Americans are not reflected in the commercial media at all.
Right.
And if you get glimpses of it, we make fun of them.
Right.
That's it.
they're being chased by cops in that show, right?
Yeah, or they're like on Jerry Springer, and right. you know, they've slept with their cousin's daughter or whatever it is. You know, I mean,
right.
that's it. And
yeah.
so, and you know, you've written about them too, and so it's just, you know, the vast majority of the American public who are really suffering are just cartoonish, cartoon figures. I mean, that's why I liked your book on Eric Garner so much. Who a flawed individual as we
right.
all are. And yet by the end, you know, your heart just breaks for him, for his family, and for all the other Eric Garners and all the other people trapped in this system. So it's a very frightening time because those voices are not being heard. Those experiences are not being imparted. Even the physical reality that they live in is not disseminated through images. Yeah.
Right. I mean, but like, for instance, your story, I think her name was Christine Pagano,
yeah,
the
yeah.
one, like, this, like, I thought that was such an interesting way to do that story, talk about the opiate crisis. You just followed her whole
yeah.
progression, right, from just beginning to take a few pills
yeah.
here and there.
And that's how it usually starts.
Right. And next thing you know, you're in Atlantic City being stabbed and raped
yeah,
at the same
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
And, but that's a... That was such an affecting story, and yet why isn't one of those stories on television basically every day, right? I mean,
well, because it's a downer, and because
right.
it's all about profit. It's all about you know, it's commercial. It's the look. I mean, now it was bad enough when you had newspaper empires, Hearst, and everything else, but now it's different. Now you have like huge corporations, Viacom or whatever. And news is just one revenue stream of perhaps hundreds of revenue streams. And that revenue stream competes. And if you can't compete, you're replaced, which is how you get Zucker on CNN. CNN is just ESPN for politicians.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah.
Did you
yeah.
say that?
No.
Somebody
said, like, Washington was Hollywood for ugly people, but it's the same concept.
No, that's
concept,
the New York
right?
Times.
Is it?
Yeah.
Can you set up the story? Because people who don't know it.
Oh, sure. I'm sorry. Yeah,
no, it's okay.
Can you talk about a little bit about Christine Pagano? Or I mean, just that.
Well, I write. So the book, America, the Farewell Tour, it's based in the understanding by the sociologist Emile Durkheim,
right.
his great book called On Suicide, where he goes out in France and asks, what is it that drives individuals or groups of people to engage in willfully self-destructive
right.
behavior? And he says it's this rupture of social bonds. That's where we get the term anomie.
Right.
And that's, of course, what's happened. That's the root. The social bonds have been ruptured. People feel they don't have a place. People feel they don't have a future. People are forced to live without dignity, and work is about dignity.
Yeah, you talk about that in the Scranton chapter,
yeah.
too, right? Like that would, it's not just about paying a check.
It's
you gotta,
not. That's
right.
right
yeah,
and,
yeah.
and so at that point, people begin to engage in behavior that is suicidal. That's what the opioid crisis, that's what the addiction to gambling is about, suicide, hate groups. Durkheim
right.
writes that people who seek the annihilation of others are always driven by feelings or desires for self-annihilation. And so she was kind of lost. Her father or stepfather, I can't remember, slept with one of her high school classmates. She felt ostracized the minute she starts taking pills. Next thing you know, she becomes a heroin addict and engages in prostitution and almost dies. And
like numerous times.
Yeah, numerous
yeah.
times. So, yeah, that's... But, I mean, go to Ohio. I don't know if you've been to Ohio, but, I mean...
Yeah.
Or southern West Virginia. I did a book with Joe Sacco called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, out of the poorest pockets of the United States. But we go to these old coal camps, and it was like interviewing zombies. Everybody was on OxyContin.
Mm.
I mean, people we interviewed, 30-year-old, like 2 weeks later, they died. You know,
wow.
it was, but that's like, and that's what happens when, you know, that's why George Bernard Shaw says the greatest crime is poverty. And I've been all over the world. Poverty manifests itself in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So we make, you know, in our what Malcolm S. called our internal colonies, poor people of color are thrust into poverty.
Right.
They engage in self-destructive behavior that everybody who, and now of course we're seeing it ripple out with the white working class, who've come next.
Right.
But it's all the same. It's all the same disease. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Which is a really unpopular take lately. It's become this taboo to kind of express any empathy towards the white working class among certain sectors, obviously. But there are a lot of people who will say, oh, you're catering to racism, which I think is a really dangerous narrative.
Yeah, it is. And I'm not excusing the behavior. First of all, half of my family comes from the white working class in Maine. I mean, gun racks, the whole bit. They didn't like anybody who wasn't Protestant, white, and from Mechanic Falls. I mean, they hated all the people from Boston.
Right.
Jews, Catholics, there was a long list. I mean, I love them. I mean, they're my family. But I kind of dealt with them because I said, go ahead, you can talk about gay people like that at home, but not in front
of
them. That's all right. But the suffering is real. I mean, you go up to these, and I remember these towns, in small towns in Maine from when I was a boy. They're gutted. The banks are closed up. There's one methamphetamine lab after another. It's really tragic. And we do ourselves a great disservice by not acknowledging that suffering. Now, why is the white working class so dangerous? Because as the theorists of revolution, Crane Brinton, Jeffrey Davies, and others have pointed out, revolution's not caused by poverty. Revolution is caused by a significant section of the population who are thrust into dire circumstances and believe that they have no possibility for advancement, that the expectations that they once had for themselves or their children are cut off.
It's the gap between expectations.
And so that's what we're seeing. And the longer the white working class is demonized, and the real issues, I was in Anderson, Indiana for the book, so a big GM center, and it's a wasteland. I mean, they didn't just abandon the plants, they tore them down, so these gigantic weed choke lots where they used to have these gigantic plants, you know, just behind cyclone fencing, and the city's in a death spiral, and of course the opioid, everything is. And they all voted for Sanders in the primary. They didn't.
Right.
And I was talking with the old UAW people. They said, okay, we know you're going to vote for Trump, but vote the Democratic slate for the state.
Uh-huh.
They didn't even do that.
Right.
They weren't going to vote for Clinton.
Right.
I mean, you know, we talk about lies that Trump. Trump lies like he breathes.
Yeah.
But the lies that did the most damage came out of Clinton and Obama and the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and similarly, that's used as an anti-Sanders line, which is that he appeals to some of the same people that Trump does, which is what makes you literally, definitionally electable. But again, there's such contempt. There's this expectation or this like demand that you just turn your backs on certain people. And again, this isn't about, you're not throwing anyone under the bus for the sake of anyone else. Like when you acknowledge the causes of
when I finished that book on the Christian right, and I went in there with the prejudice of, you know, the liberal class, where I kind of thought these people were all yahoos, and I was at the Creationist Museum in Peterborough, Kentucky, where they had, I'm not making this up, a reconstruction of the Garden of Eden with T-Rex with a saddle, because Adam and Eve used to ride T-Rex around. And
they're on it, isn't there?
They're actually in the water and naked, but Eve's position, so you can't see her plastic breasts or anything. And the guide is saying, well, I'm sure you all wonder why T-Rex has such big teeth. It's because they use T-Rex to open the coconuts.
Like
that. Then we went into the Noah Ark exhibit, and how did they get dinosaurs on the ark? Well, Noah only put babies dinosaurs on the ark.
Oh, that's so cute.
Oh, is this
cute.
The Kentucky Museum?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That's one of my favorite places
there
in the country. Yeah.
So, but I came away, I actually wrote my first chapter on the book was called Despair, because the stories that these people endured, the sexual assault, domestic violence, struggle with alcoholism, opioid, everything, bankruptcy, evictions were real.
Yeah.
And it thrust them into this world of magic Jesus.
Right.
And by the end of the book, I said, if you want to break the back of this movement, these people have to be reintegrated into the economy and the society. Otherwise, forget it. And of course, now it's worse.
Yeah. Even if you have no empathy, just if you care about.
Yeah, but you can't hear those stories and not.
No, I know. Yeah. But I have it. I think we all have it here at this table.
Right.
But even people who couldn't care less and who think that all these people have like a full set of teeth per family, you know, all these like stereotypes.
Cliches, yeah.
Yeah. Even if they care about the victims of racism and sexism, misogyny, and homophobia, all the things they claim to care about, then they need to. We need to be addressing.
Yeah, but
this.
The important thing to remember is that these people are being used. I mean, their despair is being manipulated by these mega pastors who are white male millionaires.
Right.
And people say, well, how can the evangelicals build an alliance with Trump? I say, no, you don't get it. The only difference between these megapastors and Trump, at least from my reporting, is that the sexual proclivities of the megapastors is probably kinkier. But they're the same people.
Right.
Totally, Joel Osteen. I mean, these people are just scum.
Right.
They are totally the same people.
Right.
Right. It's actually the same legend of success.
Right. Yeah.
You follow me and you'll get to...
Yeah, he just talks about his sex life and they don't.
Is there... I feel like when I read your stuff now, that is there like a Studs Terkel element to what, to the mission that you're going? I mean, essentially, I feel like you're filling a role of just relaying what the actual experiences of ordinary people are. Like that's kind of a form of reporting that's been devalued almost completely.
It's called journalism.
Right, I understand
that's what
that.
We should be doing.
That's what we should be doing.
We should be lifting up the voices who without us would not have a voice. That for me is the fundamental definition of journalism. It's what you do, and it's why I admire your work. And we've forgotten that. It's
right.
Not about sitting around interviewing powerful people. That's puts you in the role of a courtier, not a journalist. So I kind of look at it as absolutely basic and fundamental to what it means to be a journalist. But unfortunately, that is, a vision that has just been completely marginalized within the media landscape.
I mean, the model now for being a reporter, what you just said, this really speaks to something that really bothers me, is that it so emphasizes the closeness to high-level sources,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
like that's who the big stars are in the business now, or the people who know eight people in the NSA in the White House or whatever it is, and that's your daily news cycle, is a continuous
right.
series
and
of updates.
And they lie to you, and you repeat the lies. I mean,
right.
Explain to me how that is journalism.
Right. And what you do, on the one hand, it's simple, right? You just walk outside, basically, right? But you have to be able to have the ability to empathize and connect and understand what the forces that are behind everything. And isn't that the job? I mean,
yeah.
It seems like...
Yeah. But it's also fun. I mean,
yeah,
I'm sure
it is,
you feel
yeah.
it too. I like reporting.
Yeah.
I find it... I enjoy it. And I learn a lot. And
mm-hmm.
my own expectations get shattered. It keeps you intellectually fresh. I mean, you're not, living off past capital. You're forced to go out. I'm writing a book now on prisons. I teach in prisons right. in New Jersey. But I'm driving around and interviewing the kids, interviewing the mothers in housing projects in Patterson and everywhere else. And, we were talking before started the show about Russell Banks,
mm-hmm.
I think probably America's greatest novelist. But Russell, that's what keeps his stuff fresh. He's constantly going out. And his last book was on he read an article in Miami about people, sex offenders
right.
living under a bridge.
Right.
And he went down there with a notebook and it's, yeah. So,
right. And you do have to find a way to look at the world from their point of view,
yes.
which is not always easy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But it seems like this prison experience of yours has really been, it's exhilarating for you.
I love
right?
those guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
yeah. You teach, right, as well?
I teach through Rutgers. So
yeah.
I teach in their BA program, yeah.
I know we've had you on for a while already. Just a couple of things. Has the business of journalism changed at all in any fun? In the last, I don't know, 5 years or so. Like, what's your vision of how the business works these days? And what, especially the New York Times. It seems like they've, even since you were there, they've changed their stodgy old ways a little bit. If you had any insights into that, they've had a lot of really interesting controversies in the last couple of years, including the release of that town hall with Dean Baquet and everything.
Well, the Times is a diminished organization. I mean, it's always an elitist publication, of course. I think for me, the most disturbing thing is kind of what gravitas it had is gone.
Mm.
The book review is awful. The Week in Review, the op-ed page. I mean, where do they find these people?
Brett Stevens?
First of all, they can't even write. Much less think.
Brett Stevens.
It's appalling.
I love him.
And then they kind of... there's the tone, is different. It's kind of Times light, I think. And because it's lost that gravitas, it spent 2 years slogging the whole Russiagate stuff, which I don't want to sit here and keep quoting you. You pointed out, I think you're right, is probably more devastating than selling us the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They're kind of morphing into MSNBC into print, and I hate MSNBC.
One of my favorite genres of New York Times coverage is the how do the Israelis feel about this violence that they're inflicting on Palestinians?
That's nothing new. That is so old. That's
actually, Chris has some unique insights there because you want to talk about that?
Well, the way it works, let's say I was in Gaza when Israel carried out airstrikes against various Jabalia, various refugee camps. And so out of Tel Aviv, they go, a surgical airstrike against a bombing. Well, this is was great for me because I was there and I counted the bodies and I said, no, the whole street was destroyed. I mean, it was within the narrow confines of American journalism. I could expose the Israelis' lie. So, but what they do is when you're writing about a particular assault, and this did not happen in other conflicts I covered for the New York Times, like Bosnia. Every other paragraph is the Israeli Defense Force spokesperson.
Right.
So Ahmed says his entire family was killed by a bomb. Well, in Tel Aviv, Colonel says that's just completely untrue. Maka's family is perfectly fine, or whatever.
Right.
And so it's this kind of back and forth, kaleidoscope, weird kind of journalism, and the end of it, you can believe whatever you want to believe, but it essentially mutes or dilutes so effectively the truth. Now, if I talked about a massacre in Bosnia, I was kind of required to try and call Belgrade or somewhere, Pale or something, to get a no, we didn't do it or whatever.
Right.
But that was it. But that's not, you watch, that's how the New York Times will effectively disarm stories about atrocities against Palestinians.
Can I ask one more question?
So
we talked about how Sanders brought up, Jeff Bezos not liking him, and maybe that's why he doesn't get a lot. He goes after Jeff Bezos. Maybe that's why he doesn't get a lot.
Well, the Times is pretty awful to him, too.
Totally. But when he said that statement about the Washington Post, all these people were scandalized and said it was a conspiracy theory. And we played audio of a woman, a reporter, being like, when you go after the standard that is the Washington Post, and even Marty Baron himself says it's a conspiracy theory, as if that's weird. He's like the first person who would say it's a conspiracy theory. But
the Marty Baron.
Yeah, the Marty Baron, like the person who has a conflict of interest with saying it's not a conspiracy theory. But I think a lot of people don't understand how this kind of narrative control works. I mean, I don't know. Is it censorship? Is it soft censorship? The way that people are kind of either self-selecting.
No, it's not censorship.
So what's the term?
It goes back to the point I made before that you know what the paper wants, and when I worked at the Times, you had 1,200 people who worked there. 1,150 knew damn well what was good for their career. Look, everybody who covers the Middle East, I'm very outspoken against Israel. But everybody who covers the Middle East, everyone, they don't argue with any of my opinions. They just don't say in public.
Right.
Sure.
Because it's not good for the career.
Right.
And institutions like the Times or the Post hire primarily careerists.
Right.
That's how you get there, and that is how you advance. And so, they can have this kind of faux notion of impartiality and objectivity and the truth and, all this stuff you get fed. But that's not how it works.
Well, that was great. I mean, you know what they say about the second time around with Chris Hedges? It's even better than the first.
Is that what they say about the second time around with Chris Hedges?
Right.
All right. Excellent.
Yeah. So that was Chris.
Yeah.
Chris Hedges. Great
the
interview.
Chris Hedges.
The Chris Hedges and THC.
THC? The Hedges Chris?
TCH.
Right.
Okay, yeah, I was just making sure you're on your toes.
That was great. That was Chris Hedges, and thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks for watching, listening to Useful Idiots, and we will see you next week. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes
because screw Pod Save America. Those people suck.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.